You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
What do you think you would do if you'd actually had to do it for real? If it was the real thing, what would you have done?
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations episode 30, which is a fascinating visit I made to the Rushton Spencer Royal Observer Corps nuclear monitoring post in Staffordshire in the UK. The equipment used in today's episode has kindly been provided by our supporters who make monthly donations via Patreon, and I'd like to say a special thanks to all of them. If you would like to support the podcast further and get access to some exclusive extras, then go to our website at coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. Now back to today's episode. My instructions were to meet in the Royal Oak pub car park, where I would be escorted to the post. Right on 11 a.m, David appeared and guided me up various little used country lanes up into the hills above Rushton Spencer, and then we turned onto a rutted track. This went up further until a small, well-kept compound appeared over the ridge. Welcome to Rushton Spencer Royal Observer Corps Post. I'm here today with David at the Rushton Spencer Royal Observer Corps post. Now, I've been wanting to visit one of these posts for quite some time. It is a lovely sunny morning in Staffordshire today. When were you signed up to the Royal Observer Corps?
Myself, I joined in as late as 1982 and only managed 9 years because we were stood down in 91. And basically it was through a colleague of mine who was a member, and he just came along one night and said, do you fancy doing something different?
And did you know about the Royal Observer Corps before then or not?
Not really, no. It was, should we say, unknown. That's probably the best way of putting it. Although it wasn't secretive, it wasn't widely advertised as such.
Yeah, and what was your job at the time? Were you working?
I was working. For my sins, I was a TV engineer.
Oh, okay. So you were the comms and technical expert in the post, were you?
Well, unfortunately, we weren't allowed to do much. Everything was supplied for us. But obviously, if there were any issues, then I was always the first port of call, yeah.
So we've just entered the compound of the post. When was this actually built, this underground post that I can see in front of me?
Right, well, the date on this particular post is somewhat unknown. The majority of the posts were built between 58 and 65. The nearest we can get is early 60s. There are murmurings that it was 63, but it's unconfirmed.
What I can see here, and I will be putting photos on the website, is a sort of raised grass mound with a couple of structures on top. One looks like the entry structure, and the other one appears to be ventilation. But I'm sure Dave will go into more detail shortly on that. So let's proceed. We're now looking at the entrance to the post. Dave is getting out a chunk of keys here to open a substantial padlock to open the hatch. Is this sort of similar to what would have been on the post at the time?
In most cases, yes. The post hatches did tend to evolve over time. The basic hatch was the square structure that you see with the two padlocks. Mm-hmm. Some posts, unfortunately, were prone to degrees of vandalism, and as such they had the added extra security bar.
Right.
This wasn't standard on our post. We acquired it, So we fitted it.
Now, interestingly, Dave told me earlier that we're we've not come particularly well equipped today with torches. So he assures me that once my eyes get used to the gloom, I will be fine. So we're just opening the hatch now, and I'm going to...
Not scared of the height,
sorry. No, that's not a height, really. Right.
Ladders tend to put some people off. What I usually recommend for most folk is approach from this side.
Yeah.
If you feel happier, put your hand on there.
Yeah.
Step up on there and then down.
Step down.
And then you can grab there.
Okay.
Hold of this with one hand.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah. Yeah.
Then work your way down. Once you feel comfortable, then transfer onto the ladder.
Right. Okay.
When I'm down, I will shout clear, and you're then free to proceed down.
Great.
Right, clear.
Okay, and down. We're in the post now. It's safe to say the atmosphere is musty. Is this the same sort of atmosphere that you'd expect on here when it was manned, Dave?
Yes, but it does tend to get better once you've been at it for a while. I mean, obviously, as it stands at the moment, it's now September, so it does tend to be a bit cool. And unfortunately, any condensation that occurs whilst the post is manned is not so easily dispersed. But during the summer times, it's quite good, especially when you've got the place open and you get a nice warm breeze blowing through.
Yeah. But I guess when it's sealed up, it's a relatively constant temperature down here.
It is indeed. It doesn't tend to alter much. Middle of the winter, when it's unmanned, then it can be a bit cool when you first come in, but once there's two or three of you in here for a short while, it's quite cosy.
He's being polite there. So in the post itself, there is a double-decker bunk here. And so it's a crew of three in here, wasn't it, Dave?
Yes, there were three on duty. Originally, there would have been three bunks. But unfortunately, in their wisdom, management decided that you couldn't have three people asleep at the same time. So they took one bunk away, and rather than have two separate bunks, we decided to jack them up and turn them into bunk beds, plural, so that we could actually sit underneath them whilst we were having meetings and use the top for storage.
Yes, it's probably made it a load more spacious in here. And there's some Royal Observer Corps uniform on the end of the bunk in a very dashing Air Force blue, with Observer Corps on the shoulder and 16. Now, 16 is the group that you were in?
Correct. It was Shrewsbury 16 group that was our parent company.
And what's that next to it, David?
Right, well, we managed to acquire an NBC suit, nuclear, biological and chemical suit. Not standard issue, but it is a very basic form of protection, which was... available to forces.
So you're saying it wasn't available to the Royal Observer Corps, even though you were obviously going to be stepping out into a post-nuclear environment?
Not as such, no. Whether they were going to stockpile them at group headquarters for us to pick up with the rest of the equipment when we were put on stand two, we don't know. There's a lot of things that we weren't always privy to.
So what protection was given to the person who had to go out and change the photographic paper and bring that down?
He had a nice little cape which he could wear just to protect him from any fallout or inclement weather, which was used once he descended the shaft and passed the GZI papers through to the monitoring post room. He would then have to sluice himself down using water, which we kept in the post, and which was then pumped out using the pump and grid system that's at the bottom of the shaft.
Right. So the other side of the post from the bunks, there is a desk and some cupboards here. I can see the blast indicator, I'm presuming. Yep. You can see I've done my research here. It's not just thrown together, this podcast. Can you just take me through what that does?
Right, well, basically, it is, as you say, it is an indicator of the power of the blast from the bomb. Topside, there would be a pair of baffle plates, which basically allowed the peak overpressure from the blast of the bomb to be transferred down to the instrument. And if the instrument decided to read anything more than 0.1, then you went up and changed the GZI papers and sounded the attack warning.
How did you sound the attack warning?
Basically, poor old number three again would have the siren.
Oh, so that's there's a hand crank siren in there. Wow.
Yep. He would take the hand crank siren up top and sound the rising and falling tone to announce an impending attack.
That looks like quite a heavy instrument. That must have been quite an effort getting that up the shaft.
Yep, but everything has to go up and down.
And what's in this other crate here?
Right, well, the slightly brown crate, that is a fallout maroon. Now, when you get fallout, as Frankie says, you get three blasts on a gong, three blasts of a whistle, or three loud bangs. And this particular device gives three loud bangs.
So is this the sort of thing that would, like, launch a rocket that would then emit three loud bangs? Is that how it works? I've sort of seen photos of them.
Right. Basically, yes. It's actually a three-stage mortar. It sends off one, then another in sequence.
And David is just showing
that's
me...
That's a dead one.
Thankfully, a dummy one. And it's just like three aluminium tubes that presumably you load a cartridge in there of some kind?
Preloaded. You just connect two wires to that.
Yep.
You just connect two wires to the base, which are lowered down into the control room. Number one would have the firing box. And once it's set up and number three was clear, then obviously you would fire it.
Okay. And with Rush and Spencer being rural, you were the warning for the local population that an attack was coming in. So you were going to tell them that there was 4 minutes or so.
Yeah, if that's what we got, yeah. We were the only... Well, I won't say we were the only, because obviously a lot of local police stations, community shops, county libraries and the such had warning carrier points, which again would warn the local populace. But in rural areas like here, then we would be basically there for the farmers and the such like around.
Right. And how would you have received the attack warning?
Yeah, well, we have a device called the carrier receiver, which would normally be in its on position. And under normal circumstances, thankfully, the later version, which this is, was quiet. If we wanted to make sure it was working, we would press the test button and you would get a beep, beep, beep noise. All the while it was quiet, we were lucky. We could sit down, eat our sandwiches, drink our tea, and the world was at peace.
So did you have that on in the background, just a very quiet level? Or did you just, if you were in a state of alert, then you would have it turned on or turned up?
Yeah, once the post was manned, then it would actually be turned on. But as I say, this is the later version, and it is silent unless you press the test button.
Okay.
The previous version did used to actually sit there and beep at you all the time, which
Right. You
kept the volume down because it got a bit taxing.
I can imagine. Three of you in here with that going. It's a bit like a dripping tap. And then when the warning comes through, what changes to that tone?
Basically, you get a warbling tone, and then you get a spoken message.
A verbal message. And what would that verbal message say?
Attack warning red, attack warning red, attack warning red.
And did you have to acknowledge that you'd received that in any way?
We would acknowledge that via our post-teletalk to group headquarters.
Okay, and what Dave is showing me here is a lovely British Telecom, old British Telecom logo on it as well, which is a strange-looking sort of like speakerphone contraption is probably the only way I can describe it. And again, I'll add some photos to the website of that. So you acknowledge that, and then you get the siren out, or would you, I presume in a period of alert, you would already have the siren upstairs and ready to go rather than lose at least 3 of the 4 minutes trying to get it up the shaft?
Yeah, along with the PE set, the generator, things like that would already be up there and ready, because you would probably have been charging the post battery anyway. So that would be upstairs. And the siren, obviously, you get up there and when you're manned up, just so that it's ready for use as when and if needed.
Yeah. Okay. And I see you've got a nice ministry stapler there. Nice vintage, vintage one there. What other equipment have you got here? It looks like an interesting shelf you've got over here.
Right. Well, just below the modern carrier receiver is the old original carrier receiver, which is what would have been in various shops, police stations and the such like, and that was turned on and off with that. Also had a little tray underneath with your instructions.
Mm-hmm.
On the rest of the shelf we have the original BPI, which is in pounds per square inch, whereas the modern one is in kilopascals. Obviously,
okay, yeah. And was kilopascals the NATO standard, or was that the reason for the change? Or?
I can only imagine so, yes. I mean, it seemed silly in our sense because it's extra expense, but it's kilopascals. On the shelf, we have a variety of bits and pieces. If we start from down the bottom, we have what was the original post battery. Unfortunately, insurance won't let us keep acid in it now, so we have to have an external battery.
Okay. Is that the one in that wooden crate
it is
down
indeed.
There?
Okay. Yes, it is. Next to that is a black box, which is our homemade training fallout maroon.
That sounds very interesting. Homemade training fallout maroon. Dave is now pulling this black box out as he's piqued my interest. So is that what it would have looked like loaded?
No, because all we've done is we put a buzzer on it and three lights just to simulate explosion one, explosion two, explosion three.
Oh, okay, I got it. Okay,
that was just for our own training purposes, because obviously you don't get to play with a fallout maroon every day, and it's easier because we had annual post competitions.
Yeah,
it was easier to actually practice with something than just simulate a non-event.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's an impressive piece of DIY here with a couple of what looks like car indicator.
Absolutely.
Car indicator, like what car's that from? Do you know?
I don't, but the chap that built it, Roger Pedley, he could probably tell you exactly.
Looks like a Morris or something like that. Well, I don't know. Thank you for showing me that.
The next shelf up, we have a box with some of the original rations, the tinned rations.
Wow. So these are vintage, original. So Dave is showing me a rather rusty tin labelled curried chicken.
Rusty.
Well, it is a bit rusty around the side, or is that just dirt? I don't know.
No, it's slightly rusty. Yeah, curried chicken.
And when were these provided to the post, Dave?
Technically, they weren't. That's fruit salad.
No, that is rusty, that one.
Yes. These were what would have been supplied to the posts on transition to war when we were actually manned up. We had to go down to group headquarters and collect various pieces of equipment, and food rations would have been one of them. And this would have been the typical rations back in the 80s. As we got nearer to the stand down point, they were actually looking at the army rations, just dehydrated packs, which you could rehydrate.
Mm-hmm.
We never got to those.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So when we raided group headquarters, we managed to salvage some tins.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Have you ever been tempted to open one?
There are several tins missing out of that box. They have been opened, they have been consumed, and they were palatable.
Wow. How recently after you'd acquired them were they consumed?
About 4 or 5 years. So oh, okay. 95, 96.
Okay, nobody's dared do it since then.
No, we're all still alive. Well, correction. Those of us that ate are still alive. The other two items on the shelf, the small red can is the small petrol can for the generator. And getting a little worse for wear, unfortunately.
And yes, that has suffered from the moisture post. There. September 1990 X11 post.
Yep.
Great.
Literally in its vintage state.
Yeah. Some of the stuff here you've acquired from other posts that have shut down in the area or just other posts?
Very, very few bits and pieces. Most of the bits and pieces that we have, fortunately, were acquired from group headquarters when we were stood down. Roger, who I mentioned before, had a very, very good liaison with the staff down there. And knowing that all of it, or the majority of it, was going to be going into a big skip, we went down and we managed to purloin whatever we could.
Well, I'm very grateful you have, because it is bringing it to life more than a photo would.
Yep. It's something you wouldn't normally find anywhere other than on a already installed post. That is the mount for the GZI, the ground zero indicator, basically the pinhole camera. That's a spare, never ever been used.
I would have struggled to identify what that was, to be honest.
We have a spare mechanical time switch for the lighting, because a lot of the posts, unfortunately, in the early days, forgot to turn the posts' lighting off when they left. So right. When they come back, the battery was flat. So at some point, they changed the switches to mechanical timers. Yeah. So it was on a two-hour timer. When you came in the post, you had to wind it up. And 2 hours later, you went into darkness.
Right.
Unless somebody
and
decided.
And had to fumble around and find the switch again.
Exactly. And to that, we actually made a little flashing beacon, which we put on top of the switch so that you could always find it.
So and
electronics does come in handy.
Oh, yes. That TV engineering skills.
That's the bit.
I bet you were quite popular on that basis.
Yes.
So the Fallout Trainer Mark IV, I'm intrigued with.
This one.
Yeah.
Well, basically, that was used to simulate levels of fallout on the post equipment. And there are various versions of that. Unfortunately, I can't show you them at the moment because we don't keep them on post.
So this would plug into your equipment and effectively emulate fallout or readings of fallout on the equipment in the post?
That is correct, yes. A similar one was later developed electronically. There was a mechanical one which basically used a polycarbonate trace and was a clockwork device. And at the start of the exercise, you turned it on. You didn't know what the trace was because it was supplied by group headquarters. Mm. And you went through the exercise accordingly.
Right.
If you got fallout, you got fallout. If you didn't, you didn't. If you got a massive fallout,
yeah,
you did.
Yeah, yeah.
The next shelf up, we have a whole variety of different portable dosimeter chargers. Now, portable dosimeter was worn by every observer on the post at Manning Up, and because they're an electrostatic device, they needed charging periodically. And
what was the purpose of the dosimeter? Was it to measure radiation?
It was to measure personal radiation dose, yes.
Okay.
Which was recorded daily in the log by number one, whoever that was at the time. Most of them are of this basic type, which uses a mirror at the back to project light of that hole. which is where you would plug the dosimeter in. You would actually charge the dosimeter by cranking a charge, and then use that to add and subtract charge to the dosimeter.
Right.
So it's basically to zero it.
And when you say set the charge, you're not charging it like a battery.
No, you're zeroing the scale.
Okay. So the dosimeter itself didn't have any electrics in it?
No, it was basically an electrostatic device, and all you were doing was resetting the pointer back to zero.
Okay. So excuse my technical ineptness, but an electrostatic device, what do you mean by that?
Basically, it's like when you rub a comb on a piece of material and you get it near your hair, it makes your hair stand up. That's an electrostatic device.
Got it. And by zeroing it, you're removing that static from it.
Yeah.
But
Basically, you're charging it to zero. So you're supplying it with an electrostatic charge to bring it to zero. Radiation will reduce that electrostatic charge, but unfortunately, so does time. So this is why you have to charge it every day.
Got it, I think. Don't test me on that later,
no,
Dave, because that's a concept I'm struggling with there.
And then on the top shelf, we have a cutaway version of a portable dose rate meter. This is what number three would go out and about with to check the outside radiation levels if they were going out and away from the post.
Okay, so this isn't a Geiger counter?
No. Falsely, a lot of programs, and the last one was actually an Endeavour, where they actually used one of these, and ironically, it sits there going, ticking away, and they never did. Yeah. They were silent.
See, I've been watching too many movies. That's why I called it a Geiger counter.
Yeah, no.
So I'm getting the true story here from Dave. There was no clicking or ticking.
No. Basically, that is the bigger version of a portable dose meter.
And that was measured in Röntgens.
Röntgens, yeah.
He was the guy that invented the X-ray, wasn't he?
That's him.
You see, I know some of this stuff I do know. God knows why I know that. I'd be useful in a pub quiz, that I do know. What other goodies have you got up there? 80-box POP.
Printing out paper. Right, what that is basically is the GZI, Ground Zero Indicator, has photographic paper put in it.
Yep.
It has four pinholes in it. It's a basic camera, very, very basic. One facing each cardinal point of the compass, and literally a plastic graticule covers the photographic paper. During natural daylight, you even get a sun trace on the paper, but during a bomb burst, you will get a pinpoint on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
From that, you can then read the bearing height of the burst.
And Dave is showing me one of these.
It's called a North cassette. That's a North cassette.
Yeah.
Would hold the printing out paper facing the north direction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, you actually see that the zero line is there.
Yeah.
And you would get an elevation going that way. Because obviously, so at some point during the normal day, you'd end up with a sun trail working its way across.
Yeah.
On the south cassette normally, because it travels east to west.
Yeah.
If there was a bomb burst on the north cassette, and we'll say for argument's sake, is it? I haven't got my glasses with me, but if it was at 15 degrees, should we say, then it would be along that line. And if it was an elevation of 10, it would be there. You'd have a nice black spot.
Right.
And then the size of the spot is relevant because that determines the power of the bomb.
Okay.
So you'd end up with a black bob.
Okay.
With a shadow around it.
Yeah.
You get the umbra and then the penumbra.
Yeah. Yeah. And how would you work out the distance from here?
We don't work out the distance.
Okay. You just tell direction and the blast.
Yep.
Size.
We give a bearing, elevation and size of blast.
Right.
And various other posts will give same information, and then group headquarters will triangulate it from there.
Right. I mean, it's quite simple, but then I guess you want simple because...
You can't beat basics when you're dealing with basics.
Yeah. What else have you got that you'd...
Right, well, that thing there, rather phallic-looking item.
Yes. I think Dave's given probably the best description of that than I can.
That is actually called the FSM dome cover. Now, that is the fixed survey meter. That is where the radiation monitor goes. I have a Geiger-Müller tube, which is on the top of an extending pole.
And Dave is showing me a...
It's a telescopic pole.
Telescopic pole of some description.
Which actually goes up a very long tube to the outside of the post.
Okay, and Dave is showing me an aperture in the ceiling that this would be inserted into.
Correct. It would have the Geiger-Müller tube attached to the top of it. It would be extended to its full height.
Yeah.
And then inserted into the tube up to surface level. A cable from that would then be brought to the fixed survey meter, which was basically your radiation meter. And that's the one that you sat and watched as soon as you had fallout.
Okay, and that would only be inserted in time of an alert. You wouldn't have that cable in there all the time.
That would be inserted on post-manning.
Right.
As soon as you were called to man the post, everything is set operationally.
Yeah.
So the BPI baffle plate would be placed on.
Yeah.
The GZI would be loaded and installed, and the FSM dome cover and FSM meter would be installed.
Right. Okay. And I thought that was a walking stick.
Yeah.
Oh, the Mark 1 crowbar, I can see.
Definitely. Ideal for sorting number 3 out when he's difficult. but basically, that just a small toolbox which houses the BPI bar glass plate. It houses the spanners for attaching the FSM dome cover and the GZI, and a small wrench for removing the cover on the baffle plate pipe.
Great.
Underneath the shelf that houses those is a cupboard which we have marked as the V&A store.
Why V&A?
Valuable and acquirable.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Basically, it had silly things in it which you didn't want to go walk about.
Yeah.
As daft as it sounds, cups, kettle.
tea bags.
Sometimes.
Yes.
But basically, it was to put your personal kit in when your boat was manned. You could put it in there and lock it away.
Yeah. Okay.
The extra worktop on there is not standard. That's our addition.
That's a customization.
That's a customization to give us a bit more working space.
Yeah.
The monitoring room table is just about standard. But again, tends to vary on post to post. Some have a shorter, smaller one. Some have a slightly deeper one. No such thing as standard. We added the angled working area because it was easier than being bent over the table all the time.
Yeah.
To which there is a slot there, which is where the FSM was sat. It just makes life easier. It's all in one space.
And the ROC as an organisation didn't object to their posts being customised in that way?
As long as it was within realms.
Yeah.
You always run it by your group officer first. Generally, they wouldn't object as long as it wasn't untoward.
Yeah. So if you brought a sofa and an armchair down here, they probably would object to that. Mind you, you'd have trouble fitting it down the shaft anyway.
And you say, unless you built it down here, yes, you'd have troubles. But no luxuries as that. We weren't even allowed heating of any sort. No naked flames, no cooking, nothing.
So that curried chicken can you showed me, if you did have to crack that open, you'd be eating cold curried chicken.
Or if we were under no fallout conditions, you'd be doing it outside.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The seating arrangement in here, are these the original chairs that came with the post?
Right, well, the stool at the end there is one that was original at some point. The blue chair in the middle was a replacement in the 80s. But the original ones were nearly always the canvas and wood.
Yeah, sort of like a film, an old 1930s film director's chair.
Exactly.
I would describe it. The blue chair that Dave was describing is one of those things you get in a secondary school or something particularly uncomfortable. And the stool actually is reasonably comfortable from what...
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a back on it and is it hinged? God, that's luxury, Dave. Yes. How did that happen?
We don't know. But it was, as you say, it was quite comfortable because most chairs, the back is fixed.
Yeah.
But with this, you could actually move and it moved with you.
Yeah.
So that was very, very good.
Wow. And you've got some documents here. What's this one here? The Royal Observer Corps training camp at RAF Brodie in Pembrokeshire in 1972.
Yep. Well, every year there was an RAF camp moved up and down the country to different places. You had an annual allocation of observers. You had to apply. If you were lucky, you got to go. You had a week of intensive training on various topics. They were wide. Mm. Everything from the actual core activities to training the trainers, so to speak, so courses for the post instructor number two, and it was a very, very enlightening experience. I went on several. A lot of people would, shall we say, jolly about, but the serious people took it seriously and came away with a lot of knowledge.
So your sector control was Shrewsbury, was it?
It was indeed.
And where was it in Shrewsbury?
Hollywell Street. It's now a dentist, if I remember. A vet, sorry, not a dentist, a veterinary's practice.
So it wasn't an underground bunker of any kind?
It was semi. It was half underground. It was hardened. And when we were closed down, fortunately, the new owners separated an area, and they've got a small ROC display as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to go down and have a look at that. Is it publicly accessible? Or
I believe it may well be, yes. Number 16, Hollywell Street.
Okay. I will go and check that out next time I go in past Shrewsbury. Now, I'm presuming this very fine Royal Observer Corps crest is another rescue from group headquarters.
It most certainly is.
It's very fine. It's the Royal Observer Corps crest, which has this fine Elizabethan chap holding a burning torch in one hand. And underneath is the Royal Observer Corps motto, which is "Forewarned is forearmed."
Correct. And as you say, it was rescued from group headquarters.
I'm definitely taking a photo of that. I'm admiring that. That's great. So, got a Civil Defence Handbook number 10 advising the householder on protection against nuclear attack. So, I'm presuming this was a predecessor to the Protect and or the infamous Protect and Survive pamphlet of the 1980s. I think.
Correct. Yes, it's just basically a hardback version, which gives you. We'll say the same or similar information that Protect and Survive gave. I mean, a lot of people tended to poo-poo the Protect and Survive. But if you think about it, the only real crucial thing for the general public that have got nothing at all is basic advice. Mm. And that's what it gave.
Yeah.
It told you to find the lowest point in the house, the furthest point from doors and windows, cover it with as much as you can, i.e. use a table, cover it with doors, anything you like, because the three biggest things for protection is distance, shielding, and protection.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do as much of that as you can, you've got the best options.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Surviving.
Yeah. I mean, this book is it's about the size of what I'd call a Ladybird book. One of the kids' Ladybird books. It looks a bit similar to that, but obviously with slightly more alarming information than your average Ladybird book. And what are these things with that look like speakers down here?
Right. Well, those are the predecessors to the British Telecom Teletalk.
Oh, okay. So this is the communication device for you to speak back to group headquarters.
That's correct. Yes. The left-hand one, the grey one, that's the original issue item, along with its battery.
Still in its polythene bag.
Absolutely.
Very impressive.
Yep. Again, rescued from group headquarters. But that was your original Teletalk. That was your communications. Obviously, volume up and down, on, yeah, off, and press to talk. That was our homemade training version.
Okay.
Because again, sometimes when we were training in the wintertime, we didn't always come up to the post. We could take that with us, and we can train.
Was that constructed by you?
No, again, that was done by Roger. Roger, okay, did a lot of the construction.
The training equipment.
Yep. He was very, very adept at things like that.
So when you went to, you talk about your raid on group headquarters at Standout. Was it basically stacked full of this stuff?
There was a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff was sort of passing through, shall we say. Mm-hmm. A lot of the equipment was collected by group officers at Standout. A lot of equipment was taken to various meeting points prior to stand down. So some had already gone into and through and out of group headquarters. Mm. And basically we rescued what we could.
Yeah. Is there anything that you left behind which you wish that you had brought out that was maybe too large?
Yes, we would have liked to have got hold of one of the air filtration units, because what they were looking at one time, on the end of the post wall where we have our air vent, they were looking at a mechanical air vent system,
right,
which bolted onto the wall,
yeah,
and was a hand crank system for forced ventilation.
Okay.
We would have loved to have got hold of one, yeah, of those, but we never did.
Right.
But again, could have been practical, may not have been. It needed to be cranked for 20 minutes every hour.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, that sounds like hard work.
Yeah, it would keep somebody awake.
Yeah. The ventilation is basically this hatch, is it? This here?
Correct. You've got two hatches, two ventilation shafts at the opposite ends of the post.
Yeah.
Under normal conditions, if we were under fallout conditions, then the post would be closed, which means all the ventilation slots are shut. Yeah. So that one would be closed. There's one at the top of the shaft which would be closed. There's one in the downstairs store, stroke, right, loo, yeah, which will be closed.
Yeah.
And you would open them for an hour or so every several hours, yeah, just to change the air.
Yeah.
And obviously, under fallout conditions, you keep it to limited.
Yeah.
But obviously, you got to ventilate, because otherwise you get carbon dioxide buildup.
Yeah. No, absolutely. This one.
Right. That one is a form of crib, which basically gives you what you need to do on manning up stand to at attack warning red.
Yeah.
So it is a crib sheet. So on manning up, you'd have to make sure that the carrier receiver was on, yeah, the WV1400.
Yeah.
You'd check your FSM, GZI, RSM dosimeters. Make sure you got petrol in the can. You got your spade and siren outside. Yeah. Your maroon was ready. Check your time. Check your food, water, stocks and fuel. Load your spare cassettes for the GZI.
Yeah.
You check your maps and whatever else was needed, and set up your shifts and crew duties.
Yeah.
Then you go on to the conditions at stand to attack warning red and so on.
That's quite chilling, actually, reading that. Because it's sort of it's going through the routine of, if there was an attack, what you'd actually have to do. And
absolutely. Yeah, indeed it is. And basically that is all you would do. And after the approach of fallout, you're basically locked down anyway. Mm. The one you were waiting for was attack message white, which was the all clear.
Did you ever think that was going to come?
To be honest, you would never know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Good answer. Right, we are now outside the post, out of the gloom. But my eyes did get used to the darkness. You were right. You were right, Dave, about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even though you're only working with a 6-watt light bulb normally, by the time you've been in there for 5 or 10 minutes, it's like daylight.
Yeah. And so the post is a 3-person post. What was your role in the post?
Well, I started out, as everybody does, as a basic lowly observer. I worked my way up to being leading observer, which was post instructor at one point. And then, for my sins, ended up being chief observer. So I got control of the post.
So you were the big cheese. You were the guy that sent the number 3 up to change the photographic plates.
I could be, yes, but as it happens, if you were in the post on an actual stand to event, then you would set up your own shift system, and you would alternate the roles between the 3 of you, so that you didn't all end up doing the same thing.
Oh, that's very, very egalitarian, I think I'd call that. Okay, so you meet your friend and he says, how would you like to join the ROC? And you say yes. What was your first impression when you got up here and saw the post?
Well, I was quite surprised, really, because although Roger had told me it was an underground post, I had visions of it being accessed differently. I had visions of a slightly more grandiose container. But it does what it does. It's not overly large. It's not obsessively small. It's big enough for the 3 of you.
What was the longest you were in the bunker for?
Basically, we've done a weekend from a Friday night through to a Sunday night, when we have, we used to have 3 or 4 extended training exercises group-wide. Other events would just be a one-day or a one-night event, but 3 or 4 times a year you could end up with a whole weekend job.
Right, and that would have been one of the UK WMO exercises.
It certainly was, yeah. Yep.
And what did the exercises consist of? I mean, what were they? What was the normal routine they went through?
Well, in most cases, you go through an arrival at the post at a designated time. If they were operating a call-out procedure, then you would literally go through a call-out system whereby you would work your way down the chain of members until you got enough to man the post. Once you'd manned the post, then you literally set the post up as if you were going to transition to war, and then just literally follow the whole weekend or night as a real event, obviously under exercise practice conditions.
So would you get a simulated attack warning red coming through the communications and to that extent, or was it more of a paper exercise?
It was a paper exercise. The equipment that we had would give you all the necessary details, whether it be a first fallout or an explosion, toxin heard. There was never any messages over the carrier receiver.
Did you knew when these exercises were going to occur, so they didn't do sort of like drills to see how quickly they could turn you out?
No, not as such. If you had a annual post test, then that could be slightly different. You could end up being called out on that, but in most cases, no, you knew when they were coming.
Okay. Did you have any trouble from CND or the peace movement up here?
Not on this particular post, no, but unfortunately one of the members that used to be on our post and ended up over at Silverdale, they had quite a lot of CND incidents, shall we say, and various posts up and down the country at different points have had everything from petrol to nasty substances to super glue put in the locks, cement put over the top of the hatch, all manner of things. If they could do it, they've done it.
Right, right. What do you think you would do if you'd actually had to do it for real? If it was the real thing, what would you have done?
On the face of it, you would hope you'd do what you were going to do, and that is man the post and do your job. Unfortunately, till that happened, you wouldn't really know. There were one or two that were on the post at the time, which I suspected may not have turned up. Others, Roger in particular, would definitely have been there. Mm-hmm. He was an absolute stalwart. It would be questionable. Hopefully most people would actually turn up. It's not something you go into lightly. You are appraised of the situation when you are enrolled that this is what will happen. What you'd do at the time, don't know.
Yeah. You know, the thought that you're going to leave loved ones behind and that sort of thing must have crossed your mind.
Oh, it does, absolutely. I'm not sure what other posts did, but fortunately we had quite a good regime whereby we'd arranged that whatever crew was on, the other post members would make sure the other families and post members were looked after and kept in touch with whatever was needed to be kept in touch with. The ones that were on duty when, we'll use the phrase, the bomb goes up, everybody else would then make sure that their families were looked after.
Yeah, yeah, no, understood. What would you say was the best thing about being in the Royal Observer Corps?
It's a bit of camaraderie. It's another thing to look forward to. It's a experience. And then when you get your annual training camps, you get to meet other, shall we say, like-minded personnel from up and down the country, because they were literally from all over the country.
And from all walks of life, I presume, or were they professional people, or it was a real cross-section, I take it?
Oh, absolutely. It was a cross-section from literally people that were unemployed to businessmen. It really was absolutely across the board.
What would you say was the worst thing about being in the Royal Observer Corps?
Coming up to this post on a winter's night with horizontal snow.
Yeah, we are blessed a bit today. It's breezy, but it's dry, and we can see some blue sky. But yeah, I can imagine coming up here in the dark in horizontal snow would not be the best of scenarios. Yep. I was talking to Alastair McCann in Northern Ireland, who preserves a post at Portadown, and he was telling me that the electrical equipment would have been damaged by the electromagnetic pulse, and that you probably wouldn't have been able to communicate with group headquarters in the event of a bomb going off, which would have made the post pretty pointless, really. What's your view on that?
Well, yes, that, as time progressed, probably would have been a potential issue with the EMP. In the earlier days, of course, the teletalk was battery-operated. And in most cases, I mean, not all posts, but the majority of posts were actually fed with underground cables. Our post is, right. And most of the posts I've encountered have been underground fed.
Right.
So hopefully they would be semi-protected in that sense. But each particular post is in a cluster of four or five posts which are in direct communications with each other via the same landline, admittedly. But it is a private landline. It's not using the BT open network, or what was post office network then. Yeah. And one of the posts within a cluster would be a master post, which would have a radio. and the radio was only ever used at a designated time, so was in protection position in the post. So hopefully again that would be kept out of the way. As regards the, I use the word loosely, lunatics that would be prepared to expend a nuclear weapon on another party, you don't know whether they would, whether they wouldn't, or what they expected to happen at the other end. Everybody's hope, I suppose, at the end of the day was it was never going to happen. It got close a couple of times, but who knows? We came out of it.
Dave, I really appreciate your time today, taking time out of your day to show me around. It has been absolutely fascinating, and I'm looking forward to coming back again when you have an open day and seeing all the kit in action.
Yeah, absolutely. You'd be most welcome, and our pleasure.
Well, that's where we finish our chat with Dave. There's a ton of extra information in the show notes, including videos of the Royal Observer Corps in action and local museums you can visit, as well as contact details for Dave if you'd like to visit the Rushton Spencer post yourself. Our show notes are at coldwarconversations.com. Just click on the episodes and show notes option on the homepage. If you like what you're listening to, do join our vibrant Facebook discussion group where there's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with our guests. Just search Cold War Conversations, and we're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Lastly, if you like what you are hearing, do leave reviews with your podcast provider. Thank you very much for listening and supporting the podcast. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.